Friends, thanks for being with us. Thanks for closing out the week with us in the Gospel of Luke, as we also come to the close of kind of a scene in the narrative, the penultimate, how's that word? The next to last.
That's great. I love scene. Ultimate. That's good.
Today, the burial of Jesus. We have been walking this week through the crucifixion narrative that concluded yesterday with the death of Jesus and the words, "Into your hands I commit my spirit." And now Luke gives us the follow-up, the aftermath. Some interesting stuff in this, again, in Lucan style, well-written, dense and short, but some stuff that I think is interesting. So read through it, and then we'll discuss it when we come back. Now there was a good, righteous man named Joseph, who, though a member of the council, had not agreed to their plan and their action. He came from the Jewish town of Arimathea and was waiting expectantly for the kingdom of God. This man went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Then he took it down, wrapped it in a linen cloth, and laid it on a rock-hewn tomb where no one had ever been laid. It was the day of preparation, and the Sabbath was beginning. The women who had come with him from Galilee followed, and they saw the tomb and how his body was laid. Then they returned and prepared spices and ointments. On the Sabbath day they rested, according to the new commandment. So this is a character, Joseph of Arimathea, that shows up in the Gospels, who, though ties to the religious leaders, is not among them in terms of their work against Jesus. Whether he is a follower of Jesus or friendly to Jesus is not completely clear, though certainly this act of service and this act of generosity would tend to tip the scales, I think, in favor of a follower. And he goes to Pilate. He makes a case for the body. He puts that body in a place where no one had ever been, a new tomb or an unused tomb. There is, interestingly here, there is no mention of the stone. When we get to Easter, that will be mentioned, but Luke doesn't, in his sort of sparse telling of the story, doesn't even mention that part. And really, Michael, fairly anticlimactic here. Jesus' body is left on the cross. There is this man who comes and gets it. The women are there again because, as we've had that conversation this week, that's important to Luke, and they are important to the story. And then there's some other details we'll get to, but I think, this man, Joseph of Arimathea, like Simon of Cyrene, shows up, dropped into the story, plays this pivotal role, important for some reason to Luke, that he so important that he names him. I don't know that we know anything about him or what happens to him following this, but an interesting twist in the story.
I think that I was going to go directly to Simon as well, Clint. I think that it's important that we recognize that in the story of Jesus's death, it is at this moment, an unexpected moment, to be honest, that we have the introduction of new characters. It would not have surprised us if Peter made an appearance, as we've seen Peter multiple times throughout the book of Luke. But no, we're going to have Simon, who I think, as we mentioned in that text, in that story, I'll maybe drop that in the description in the event that you'd like to learn more about his part in this story. But he came from a foreign land. He would have represented a group of people who would not have been first on the list of notability at the time. So I think there was an emphasis that would have appealed to Luke in that. I think it's fascinating, Clint, as we turn to a text like this here today, that the individual who's a good, righteous man, and there's almost this, that is almost like a disclaimer. Though he was a member of the council, he hadn't agreed with their plan of action. The idea being, he was someone in the inner circle, but he was someone who stood outside of their intention, someone who had seen Jesus for who he was. And Clint, I think that this is a really notable turn in the story, because the person that we just had previous, if you remember the study from yesterday, the people at the cross, we have the idea of the crowd who knows what they've done. We've got the Roman centurion. We've noted so many times how the religious leaders are the ones implicated for this rising action against Jesus. I think it's really, really notable that even amidst all of this, the first introduction that we have following Jesus's death is a member of the council who had not agreed to their plan in action. I almost think that this is Luke pointing out that even in the midst of the leaders that we've been looking at this whole time, there were those who stood on the side of the kingdom of God. There's, even in Luke's telling of this story, there's room for every single circle. There's someone from every vantage that saw the truth of who Jesus was. And I just think how quickly Luke transitions into this good and righteous man who was a member of the council, but yet he didn't stand with the council. That to me speaks volumes of who Luke is and what he wants us to know, that the gospel really is universal. Even the people seeking to kill Jesus had people in their rank who were good and righteous and stood outside of that.
Yeah, and I don't think you can credit Luke alone for this, because I think to some extent this is built in the gospel itself. But it is almost in these last several chapters, whoever we least expect to see, that's who shows up. Simon of Cyrene, a centurion who proclaims Jesus innocent, and now a member of the council. Of all of the guesses you might take about who's going to come and be responsible for Jesus' body and who's going to procure a tomb and take care of those details, a member of the Jewish council would be your last guess. There's just no way you can see that coming. And again, that's not Luke. Luke doesn't do that. But I do think Luke is drawn to those details. I think Luke loves the outsider. I think Luke deeply appreciates the gospel's tendency to involve surprising people. And I think we see a highlight of it here.
Yeah, Clint, I agree. I think that there's a sense, too, in which as we turn our attention to the text, I think we also see here that Pilate, and this is, as you've said, this isn't the only place where we see the story go this way, but it says something about Pilate that he's willing to allow Jesus to be buried in a place of honor. Jesus's death is not one of honor, and that's notable. But the fact that when Joseph comes to Pilate, Pilate sees no problem in allowing Jesus to be buried in a way that is respectful of both the Jewish tradition as well as respectful, of course, as Jesus is the Son of God. That's the lens that Luke has us looking through into a story like this. And the idea that when it comes to Jesus's burial, it is here into a tomb that no one has ever been laid. This is maybe a strange detail for those of us who live in the 21st century, where we are comfortable with the idea of a person being buried, and we have a whole set of processes that happen, you know, when you have to dig the space for that, and then there's the vault in which the tomb is placed, and all of these things. In the ancient world, it was not uncommon, especially for those who would be of lower economic status, to be buried in a place with many different people. That happens in many different cultures and times and places. And so the idea that no one's been laid in this place is a symbol, a sign of reverence, of honor, even of status. And in this case, Jesus is afforded a afterlife status as it relates to his body, that he clearly was not given at the last moments of his life. He was executed as a criminal, and now he's going to be buried in a place of honor.
I don't think we know this, Michael, so I want to be clear. This involves some speculation, but in Jesus' day, the idea is that contact with a corpse makes one unclean, and there's a period of uncleanliness that has to be waited out. It is possible, and again, this is speculation. I think people argue both sides of it. It is possible that in doing this for Jesus' body, Joseph sacrifices his Sabbath day the next day. In other words, he may not have been able to do some of the things that like go to the temple, for instance. He may have had to go through the period of cleanliness in order to do that. And that, yes, maybe that mattered for Joseph, maybe it didn't. But what is fascinating about that is that, again, we see this idea that by Jewish law, serving Christ may have given the ritual designation of unclean. And the banter we've had between clean and unclean, between Jewish and the religious leaders, between this full faith that Jesus tries to enact and this kind of more ritualistic application of it from his enemies. And I think it's very interesting here. And then speaking of Sabbath, I've always been struck by this last phrase, on the Sabbath they rested according to the commandments. And I think it is amazing here that given the situation, they follow the law after execution and without exception. To some extent, that's their ritual, that's their pattern. To some extent, they believe in it and they put their faith and trust in it. But how painful it must have been to want to do this ministry for Jesus' body, this work for Jesus' body, and have to be separated from that by the practice of their faith. And it has always struck me the discipline by which they set that aside for another day and waited. I don't know what it does or doesn't mean other than they were very devout, but it's a fascinating part of the story to me.
As is, I think, per your skill set, Clint, I think you see the very deeply human aspect of it. I've always read this section of the text as being another example of, yeah, and this is why you can know they didn't steal Jesus's body.
Sure.
It's this sort of evidence that these are people of conviction. They stayed home on the Sabbath like they were supposed to. They weren't out there doing some tricky thing, stealing Jesus's body and burying it somewhere else so that they could conjure up this religious idea. And yes, I understand you say, hey, you're a pastor in the Presbyterian Church, you're reading these scriptures, you're biased to read that as evidence in their favor. That's completely granted, that they are the ones who wrote this book. This is the story that they're telling us. If you want to disbelieve that, you're free to do that. But there's a sense in which the earliest generation of Christians, I think, did, both from that very deeply human aspect you just shared, Clint, the idea of look at these men and women who are faithful to execute God's law in their life, even at the very death of Jesus. That's the same kind of inspiration that, of course, that they would share with the earliest generation of Christians who are facing real martyrdom and really being sought out on the Sabbath and yet still taking time to go to worship, still putting themselves in harm's way. And then I think there's also a kind of a faith confidence building element to this, to say that, hey, you can trust and have confidence in the witness that you've been given, because the people who have wrote it and the people who are delivering it to you are people of faith. They're people of tradition. They're people of character. And you can see that even at the moment of Jesus's life and death, they're going to care for him as best as they can, but they're also going to keep God's will. They're going to do what's right. And they're the kind of people, therefore, that you should be able to trust.
It brings us to an interesting part in the story, Michael. This is a false distinction, because Luke, I don't think, writes it this way. Keep in mind, there aren't numbers and verses in the original. We added that later. That was not part of the original texts. But from an interesting perspective, this is a dividing line. If you ask historians and people who aren't of the faith, this is the part of the story, this is the line that divides what everybody would believe and what it means to be a believer. Okay, the miracle stuff that Jesus does, that non-believers are going to have some difficulty with that. But the fact that he lived, the fact that he preached, the fact that he had disciples, the fact that he moved around as an itinerant, the fact that he fought with religious leaders, the fact that he ended up on a cross, that's only disputed by a few people. Realistically, most people are going to agree to the facts of that part of the story, or at least that those parts of the story are not, even people who are not faith people are going to say, yeah, we can see that those kind of things happened. But this is the dividing line. This is the last part of the story that everyone could agree on.
Right.
That Jesus was dead and went into a tomb. That is a dividing line. And it's interesting, you know, that's 90% of the gospel.
Right.
And the 10% that comes next is what happens on the other side of that line. And I think, you know, just from a narrative standpoint, it is a significant moment to realize that we are now at the last part of the story that virtually everyone would agree on. And what comes next is very much a dividing line.
Yep.
That belongs to people of the faith. And that's not a criticism of anybody. It's just inherent in the way that the story unfolds. And this is the last thing which everybody would be on the same page.
There's something that I want to really emphasize in that, Clint, and that is that proportion. Let's use 90-10, whether that's the exact number or not. It is certainly the majority of the text comes before the resurrection turn. One thing I think we have to learn from that is that the nature and truth of the resurrection, Luke does not believe needs to be contained in words following the resurrection. He believes that you need to be introduced to who Jesus is and who he was. Luke's conviction is very clearly that if we understand the person Jesus, if we understand his teaching rightly, if we are able to see with eyes of faith the works that he did, Luke's argument throughout this entire passage, this entire book, has been to make the case that if you see who Jesus is, then you will know that he's not only the Son of God, but he's the called one who's came to be the turning point of history. If you see that in Jesus's life, if you see that in his work, then at this moment, at this pivotal crossroads, you will be able to make the choice of whether you can take the journey or not. Whether if you believe the first 90 of Jesus's life as Luke presents it, then you're prepared to take the step into the verse that comes next. And if not, I think it's telling, but they rested on the Sabbath in obedience to the commandment. That may be the last point that you could travel with us along the journey and say, yep, to this point, you have religious people who are doing their religious duty, and that was the end of Jesus. Of course, those within the faith, those to whom Luke is writing and those to whom Luke is hoping will receive the book and be compelled by it, they see in it an invitation in their own life to take that step into, through Sabbath and into the day that will follow. And of course, the question that lives there is, what will you do when you get to that other day?
Yeah. And just very quick, just to unpack that word so there's no misunderstanding. When it says they rested, it means they refrained from doing work. It doesn't mean they were at peace. It doesn't mean they were comfortable. All of the things that you would expect them to be feeling in the aftermath of Jesus being crucified within a day's time, they are feeling shock, anguish, anger, all of the rest. When it says they rested, that's not talking about the character of their day. That's talking about the Jewish restriction that those funeral tasks were not to be done on the Sabbath, and they follow those things. So, an interesting transition that Luke gives us to the next part of the story.
That's where we'll leave it for today. We're certainly glad that you would take the time to join us for a study like this video. If it's been interesting, thoughtful, helpful to you, it helps others find it in the future in the midst of their own study. Of course, subscribe, because we have a lot to come in the book of Luke and then in studies afterwards. Until we see you next Monday, be blessed.
Thanks, everybody.